Good morning and welcome to day two of our Brookfield Investor Meetings. My name is Suzanne Fleming and I manage branding and communications for Brookfield. For those of you who didn't attend yesterday's meetings, I just want to give you a bit of information on the iPad we're introducing for the first time this year. As I mentioned yesterday, these are not the giveaway items, so we'd like to ask that you return them to the registration desk following your last meeting today. In terms of functionality, they're pretty straightforward, just a couple of items to note. First, we'll automatically push each presentation into the iPad. Then by tapping on the note button icon on the top right, you can take notes on each slide. Clicking the done icon then saves the notes. The presentation with your notes in it will be emailed to you within 2 hours of the end of the meeting. Then clicking on history on the top right of the screen will allow you to go back to the previous slides of the presentation. To get back to the slide being shown, click on the live presentation button on the bottom right. There's also a user guide icon on the home screen if you need further guidance. For any other issues, just ask at the help desk outside. And finally, there are tables in between each seat, so if you need to write on something, you can just swing that table out. And with that, I'll hand it over to Sam.
Well, thanks, Suzanne, and good morning, everyone. Thanks for coming this early to hear us speak, and it's nice to see lots of familiar faces, friends, and long-term investors. For those who don't know me, my name is Sam Pollock, and I'm the CEO of Brookfield Infrastructure Partners. And I guess let me just get the slides rolling here. Apologize for the provocative slide, but what we wanted to get across was the fact that it's been a pretty remarkable year with lots of unexpected events. And even though it's been a fairly decent economic environment, it seems that investors have been switching between risk-on and risk-off strategies. And so we thought that the theme for today from a Brookfield Infrastructure perspective would be to tell you how we can provide secure cash flows for risk-averse investors, as well as growth for those looking for capital appreciation and inflation protection. So before we get to today's presentation, though, I'm just going to very quickly give a recap of the year. So I guess the first question is, how have we done? And I'd say it's been a pretty good year so far. If we look at some of the metrics that we follow, FFO per unit remains strong, where we've delivered growth of about 12% year over year, and this has been driven by very good same-store results. We've also increased our distributions twice this year, delivering an overall 11% year over year increase, which exceeds our target in the 7 to 9% range. And we've deployed about $1 billion of capital towards five transactions, growing our energy and transport segments and really setting ourselves up for the future. Last year, we highlighted why we thought it was a good time to invest in Brookfield Infrastructure. And I thought, given that these sort of represent a lot of the priorities that we went into this past year, I'd use them as a bit of a basis for describing how we did. So the first one was, in our transportation business. And obviously the Asciano transaction was front of mind last year. And, we described why we're excited by the quality of our transport assets. And you'll recall that we have a leading South American toll road business. We've got rail operations in Brazil and Australia. And we have ports in North America, Europe, and because of the Asciano transaction now in Australia. And since last year, we've only made it better. We've invested about $720 million. We've acquired these high-quality ports in Australia, two of which are some of the most automated facilities in the world. We've expanded our existing road, rail, and port networks. And we've added new roads to our networks in India and Peru. The second theme we spoke about was about how there was a crisis of confidence going on in Brazil, which we thought would surface a number of really compelling opportunities for us to acquire high-quality core infrastructure assets. And all I can say is, boy, did it ever. We're pleased that we were able to execute this strategy, and we did it when, you know, as Bruce said yesterday, probably at the bottom of the market. Our focus was on both electricity and gas transmission assets, and we've signed deals to invest approximately $1 billion. These transactions include the most notable one, which is the Brazilian natural gas transmission business that we bought from Petrobras, a business we call NTS, and Ben's going to tell you a lot more about that later on. You know, one of the most important priorities that we talked about last year, and frankly, we probably talk about every year, is just our objective of delivering sustainable and growing cash flows. And while short-term results are important for us, I think what we're most proud about is our track record of doing this year after year. And, you know, not only on the FFO perspective, but also from a distribution target perspective. The last matter we talked about last year was just our whole strategy around diversification. And this past year, you know, I'm pleased to say that you know, we were able to, you know, continue that very important risk management strategy by diversifying our businesses geographically. We acquired two sets of toll roads, one in Peru and one in India, and we think those are going to be great regions for us, as those are high growth markets and ones where we expect to be able to invest capital for a long period of time. In addition to that, you know, we also were looking to target new sectors, and we set out the water sector and the airport sectors as areas we'd focus on. Now, you know, the airport sector, you know, our goal was to be able to get into it through a transaction called Invapar. This was a business that was being restructured in Brazil. Unfortunately, after we did our due diligence, we decided this was not a transaction for us, and so that won't be our entry point, but we learned a lot, and I'm confident that there will be an airport transaction in the future. However, we did get into the water sector, and we're pretty excited about it. Even though it's a relatively modest investment at this point in time, you know, we acquired a water developer that has a late-stage project in California to build a water desalination plant in Orange County. It comes with a very seasoned management team. The project will be about $800 million, you know, when we get it up and running, and we expect to earn very attractive returns. And probably the most important element of that is that we now have a platform and something to build from. So we're very, very pleased that we're able to do that. And we've also had a number of other wins. We increased our ownership in NGPL to 50% alongside Kinder Morgan, our partner. We increased our capital backlog by over 50% to $2 billion, which is our highest ever. We've recycled $1 billion of capital, you know, back into our business at better returns. And we raised $10 billion of third-party capital to invest alongside us. And this is a very important part of our strategy. You know, I mentioned in our letter that, you know, one of our key strengths is our ability to acquire large, high-quality infrastructure assets around the world. And if we didn't have that capital alongside us to invest, we wouldn't be able to do the types of deals that we've been able to do. So we're very excited about that. So that's the quick recap of the year, and I guess now we'll get down to business. So first on the agenda, we have Brian Baker. He's going to talk about our high-quality assets in our energy and communications infrastructure segment. This is our spotlight for this year. Next, Ben Bond's going to come up and discuss you know, our investment strategy and how we're able to deliver growth through contrarian investing. Third, Bahir's going to come up and do a financial review and really focus on our high-quality cash flows. And then lastly, I'll come back up and talk about why we think it's a good time to invest in BIP. I will say before I turn over to Brian that we will take one or two questions after each segment, but we'll try and limit that just to make sure that we get through the presentations. And if we have time at the end, we're happy to take as many questions as you have. So I'll turn it over to Brian.
Thanks, Sam, and good morning, everyone. My name is Brian Baker, and I'm a managing partner in our energy group, and I also spend a considerable amount of time working in our communications infrastructure business in Europe. Let's get to the right slide. So my first slide here highlights our global infrastructure presence, but before I jump into the presentation material, we thought this would be a good point to start with our first polling question of the day. And the question is, what region do you think will have the greatest need for infrastructure investment over the next 10 years? So you should see coming up on your screens a map, and you can choose the region you think is going to require the infrastructure investment. And then I think the results should come up fairly quickly. I think we have a clear winner emerging. Well, look, I think, looking at the results as they come up here, clearly what's happening with North America and Brazil falls within a lot of, our strength and where we're really focused. I think we'd agree with, what we've been seeing in India, that is definitely a market that's going to require a lot of infrastructure investment. And as Sam highlighted in his opening, it's an area that we're fairly focused on. Okay, so I guess I'll jump back into the presentation now. And I'm going to spend about the next 20 minutes highlighting our energy and communications business. I'm going to walk you through kind of the key attributes that we think make these businesses great assets, as well as spend a little bit of time talking through some of the organic growth opportunities that we see in the business today that we're pretty excited about. So combining energy and communications together may seem like a bit of an odd combination, but really they share key investment themes that we think make them leading assets in their sectors. We often describe our businesses as unique, and this is generally due to their size, their scale of operations, or how well they're going to be positioned inside their sectors. Our assets perform essential services, and while they may not directly interact with an end public user, our businesses are necessary for the provision of these services. The businesses and the services that they provide are very difficult to replicate, and this is generally determined by a number of reasons due to, the sheer cost to replicate the assets, high customer switching costs, regulatory and permitting hurdles, or potentially just the ability to acquire land, just to name a few. And it means that our assets are generally going to be in high demand. They're going to have limited competition, and our customers are going to tend to be sticky. Now, when you combine the attributes of essential services as well as assets that are difficult to replicate, then you have the right ingredients for high-quality cash flows. Our customers tend to want to have long-term assets or access to our assets, which gives us the ability to pass on inflation as well as a portion, or if not all, of our operating costs, which gives us great visibility to high-quality cash flows over the long term. And finally, our businesses present us with great organic growth opportunities, and I'm going to walk through a few of these as we move through the slides. Through targeted M&A and execution of our roll-up strategy, our presence in the North American energy sector has grown quickly, and we've established core positions in key energy hubs. Our transmission business is one of the largest and most geographically extensive natural gas pipeline businesses in North America, and it's complemented by over 600 BCF of gas storage, which makes us one of the largest operators in this sector as well. We have unmatched access to major supply basins, providing optionality for customers. We have flexible interconnectivity to attractive end-user demand markets with over 215 physical interconnections with local distribution companies, third-party pipelines, and gas-fired power plants. And we have long-standing relationships with a diverse, high-quality mix of customers. In a similar way, our district energy business has also grown rapidly, and we've become one of the largest providers of district energy, heating and cooling services in North America. Our business is rooted in Toronto, Chicago, and Houston, major metropolitan centers, and we've recently made smaller acquisitions to get started in Australia. And like our transmission business, we also have a very diverse set of high-quality customers in the government, commercial, hospital, and university sectors. Now, the next slide is one I'm going to spend a fair bit of time on because I think it's really important to understand the strategic nature of our transmission business. It's characterized by unique access to supply basins as well as real critical interconnectivity with end-user demand markets. And as you can see from the map, as opposed to your typical point-to-point pipeline system, our footprint is really well-placed to take advantage of the changing dynamics in the gas industry on the supply and demand side that are taking place around it. We've seen Marcellus production exceed expectations well beyond regional demand growth profiles. And what this has done is it's displaced inbound gas, and it's resulted in the reversal of pipeline systems that were previously coming into the region. We've seen conventional production continue to remain flat or maybe decline a little bit, but we've also seen the Permian shale oil discoveries that have taken place in and around Texas show very prolific opportunities for associated gas production. On the demand side, we've seen structural demand is prepared to accelerate over the next 5 years, and that's really going to be driven in the Gulf Coast region by LNG exports, industrial gas usage, gas-fired power generation, as well as what looks like emerging demand by Mexico. Now, our view is that we're perfectly positioned with our pipeline systems to benefit from these changing dynamics. Originally, the pipeline was engineered to source gas from the Gulf Coast region and Mid-Continent region with ultimate supply into Chicago. But now, NGPL finds itself in the midst of pipeline reversals that are linking growing supply basins with emerging demand centers, and we think this is a great place to be for the business. You can see on the map that we're interconnected with the REX pipeline system coming out of Marcellus in Illinois. And with recent reversals and expansions of the REX pipeline system, we're now able to offer a critical path to market for gas that had previously been trapped in this region, both in the Chicago region as well as south into the Gulf Coast, which represents the greatest demand driver for natural gas demand in North America. LNG projects under construction today are expected to increase natural gas demand by roughly 8 BCF per day over the next 5 years, with further projects that are under advanced consideration and planning potentially capable to increase that to over 10 BCF per day. And lastly, I should mention the shale discoveries that are in the Permian region and the Texas region. They sit right on our doorstep. So as the likes of Apache, you know, continue to develop their shale oil projects in there, we're perfectly positioned to be an outlet for their gas across our system to demand markets. So these changing fundamentals have enabled us to advance two meaningful projects under long-term contracts, as well as look at significant other opportunities for growth. And I'll flip back to the map slide in a minute just so you can see how they flow. So the two projects, the Chicago market expansion and the Gulf Coast reversal, are great examples of how our business benefits from the unique position of our system. And it's highlighted by customer appetite to secure long-term capacity on our pipes. So the first phase, jump back here, the first phase of NGPL's Chicago market expansion will increase firm transportation capacity north from the REX interconnect into the Chicago market. It'll allow Chicago area market participants to diversify their supply source and add the Marcellus gas to their supply, and it's going to increase or enhance the system's reliability moving into Chicago. NGPL is going to be able to leverage its existing interconnectivity in the region, which is really important because it allows us to invest $80 million, which is the most cost-effective solution for the marketplace, in the project, and we expect it to be on online in Q4 this year. Now, what's really valuable about this project for us is it's allowed us to extend both firm transportation and storage commitments with our largest LDC customer in the Chicago market for a period of 10 years. And that really solidifies NGPL's position in the Chicago market as a strategic long-term player for the long term. So the second project is the Gulf Coast Reversal Project. And so under the Gulf Coast Reversal, it's really a market-driven response to the increasing supply in the Northeast and the emerging demand in the Gulf Coast region. So back to the slide here. We're going to be looking to invest $210 million in new compression facilities as well as a modification to existing pipeline facilities. And it's going to see us take gas production from that REX interconnect, and we're going to be bringing it south down into the Gulf Coast region. And effectively, what we'll be doing is we have three gas pipelines that make up our Gulf Coast pipeline system, and we'll be reverse flowing one of those pipeline systems to bring gas back down. The project, as I said, is going to be investing roughly $210 million, and we see the project's going to be underwritten by a 20-year contract with a major LNG exporter, and we expect it to be in service in Q4 of 2018. We see additional ability to invest a similar amount of capital in a second phase expansion of the Gulf Coast pipeline system, where we'd reverse another pipe coming down. We're currently in the non-binding solicitation of interest phase for that project, and we're hopeful that we'll have enough support to move forward with that very soon. Now, looking at Mexico, as we talk about the Permian and South Texas opportunities, here, you know, natural gas has been, you know, badly underinvested in Mexico recently. And they're now looking for ways to access cheap shale supply coming out of the U.S. So we're advancing projects where we can increase deliverability into the South Texas and Permian hubs with ultimate takeaway capacity to Mexico under long-term contracts. And on the gas storage side, with LNG becoming a near-term reality, storage in the Gulf Coast region is becoming more and more strategic. We're in conversations for long-term contracts on our existing capacity, as well as a $30 million expansion of our facility there, again, under a long-term contract. So clearly, there's lots going on in our business what we're really excited about, and I think it highlights that customers are really seeking long-term access to supply and highlights the strategic nature of our assets. So moving to district energy, also possesses several important infrastructure characteristics that we highly value. Our customer relationships are long-term, and most of our contracts span 10 to 20-year periods. Our contracts have attractive inflation-linked attributes that allow us to pass on inflation and have good visibility to future cash flows in the business. And our customer loyalty and retention is evident in the fact that we have a very low churn rate of our customers. The physical infrastructure itself is very difficult to replicate, and this is especially true in cities where there's congested rights-of-ways under the street, which makes the barriers to entry very significant, especially where district energy is the established service provider in the region. And finally, our foothold in established markets leads to great opportunities for us to reinvest in the asset base, either through organic growth or through bolt-ons to the existing system. So as we think about growth in the district energy sector, it's a very fragmented system or sector with many systems, whether they're owned by utilities, municipalities, or university or campus owned, and they don't really have the ability to take good advantage of scale. The businesses are faced with capital constraints similar to the broader utility sector, and what we're seeing is private capital is really starting to be in a position to play a role to help with this. We see limited larger financial players competing in the sector. And that's really driven by the fact that a lot of the district energy projects, I'd say the majority of them might be on a smaller basis, but quite often they're also technically complex. So it's difficult for financial players to really to play in this space effectively. So what we see is a combined opportunity set within North America is very meaningful. I think as we've highlighted with the pipeline that we're pursuing right now. And what's great about our pipeline, it's made up a really good mix of opportunities. So, you know, we've got our bread and butter, if you will, the typical, maybe on an average basis, $100 million type projects to sit within that pipeline, as well as a real unique opportunity to chase a campus style opportunity under a long-term concession that could be very meaningful in the high hundreds of millions of dollars. It's important to note that while we're really well positioned to capture this growth, because we're dealing with municipalities and institutions, it can often take a little bit longer to get them to decision-making stages, and as a result, it can take us a little bit longer lead time to execute some of these projects. As we think about growth outside the American, North American market, we believe the European market presents similar opportunities for us to establish a district energy platform like we've done in North America. There are a significant amount of systems in Europe, and some people would say they're one of the more advanced regions with the use of district energy, with over 5,000 systems. So we think, and that's on the continent alone, we think there's a good opportunity to, you know, move in with an initial acquisition and then follow on growth. So that's something that we're going to be highly focused on going forward. So I'm going to move to discuss a little bit of the valuation across the sector now. And as we think about district energy first, in North America, there are relatively few really good district energy comps of scale, which makes it difficult to find some good comps there. But what we have seen in Europe is there's been an increasing number of district energy transactions taking place. They're highly competitive, and we've seen an increasing attraction of the asset class to infrastructure investors. We've looked closely both at the Corient transaction, which was based in France, and Advent that was based in the Nordics. And after taking a long look at those assets, I think we're very comfortable to say that, you know, we think our district energy business in North America is much better. We think it's driven by the fact that we have longer-term customer contracts, our business is larger and more scalable, and we see a tremendous amount more growth opportunity inside of our businesses. On the pipeline side, there have been a number of pipeline transactions in North America recently. We think kind of sets up a good group of comps. TransCanada does stand out a little bit with the comp on the Columbia acquisition, but I think once you factor in some pretty significant synergy values they believe they can deliver in that transaction, their comp will fall to around 13.5 times, which is more in line with some of the others that we've shown. So from a value perspective and how this translates to our business, as I said, we believe our district energy assets are a better business, and they would definitely fall in the higher end of that range, given the long-term contracts that we have in place, the high-quality customers, and the growth profiles. Our transmission business fits in a consistent range with the comparables. We think that, you know, given the nature of the system that I've highlighted, long-term contracts and the growth that we see there, that it would definitely fall at least in the midpoint of that range, if not higher. So on a combined basis, it means our view of enterprise value for our energy business falls in the $3.2 to $3.7 billion range. So moving to the communications sector, our French tower business was formed by the legacy broadcast monopoly of the French government, and today represents the only independent network that provides 100% coverage across the country. Over the years, the network has been significantly enhanced, and that's through the acquisition of a sizable portfolio of telecom towers, as well as the build-out of a high-speed fiber backbone grid, and now it forms the country's leading independent infrastructure utility business. The broadcast business really leads with stable cash flows, but the telecom and fiber network, they represent the formative growth engine in the business today. The trends that we see across the telecom space really highlight the growing importance that telecommunication infrastructure is playing in today's world. Mobile data demand in France has increased 82% year on year, and this just continues the explosive demand growth we continue to see across the sector. It's driven by an increase in smartphone penetration. We're seeing people move to larger screen sizes. You can see with the new iPhones that continue to come out, combined with more mobile data traffic driven by the rollout of 4G. And we don't see any of these trends looking to slow down in the near term. The data trend and consumer insistence on faster coverage and better service really highlights the growing demand for access to TDS infrastructure. And we see it coming through with the contract portfolio we have in place. We have a 20-year contract with Orange, recent renewals with both SFR and Bouygues Telecom at 10 years plus renewal options, leaves Free as our shortest-term customer with a 5-year contract. But Free also represents one of our biggest partners right now in our business, where we're helping them meet their growth requirements as they look to catch up to their competitors and meet their coverage obligations. So access to our tower infrastructure is really critical for these customers in order to provide the service that they need to. Our growth trajectory organically has very strong momentum and is driven by the coverage obligations I've talked about. We've added 1,200 points of presence, and to make it simple, a point of presence is just one piece of equipment on our towers. We've added 1,200 in the last 2 years alone, representing 15% cumulative growth in our telecom business. We have orders to fulfill another 500 by the end of the year, and we're currently responding to tenders for another 1,100. So it's been a very active part of our business. We're additionally looking at several opportunities to build new towers, and this is along rail and transport corridors in France that are badly underserviced today, as well as large-scale build-to-suit programs for mobile network operators as they look to further enhance their coverage. Combined, these opportunities are for towers in the 1,000 to 2,000 tower range. So these would be very meaningful growth opportunities for the business. And this is just focused on 4G rollout. So it has nothing built into it now for 5G, which we think as that starts to roll out in a couple of years is going to be another significant driver for growth in the business. And finally, there remains roughly 15,000 towers in the market today that are still owned by mobile network operators. And this represents a little over 50% of the market. And it's pretty clear that mobile network operators are all taking a hard look at whether they need to continue owning this infrastructure, especially at a time when they need to be investing significant amounts of capital in the rollout of 4G and 5G. So while we have a great organic growth pipeline that's really fueling the business today, the team at TDF remains highly focused on trying to secure a large portfolio of towers from mobile network operators. So the next, good growth opportunity that we're focused on in France that we hope will become the next big thing for us is on fiber to the home. Now, the slide highlights some of the industry facts, and I'm just going to focus on, what we really like about the sector and the business for TDF. So first, I think it's just the strong tailwinds that we see and the significant growth in bandwidth demand by end users, where broadband has become a real basic infrastructure requirement that's really being demanded in all markets. The second is the strong utility-like feel that the fiber to the home opportunity has in France. Once these networks are in place, they're going to be very difficult to replicate, and that's driven by the high cost to install the networks that in the absence of subsidies from the French government just wouldn't be economic to do on their own. The business is going to be an open access model, which means we can bring any of the internet service providers onto the network, and it's going to have regulated pricing, which is essential because it's going to allow our business to compete effectively with copper and be priced at the same point. So it really creates no impediment to switching for end users. And the business is going to be extremely scalable. The concessions, as they're planned, are targeting populations in the hundreds of thousands, and CapEx, aiming at an average of, say, $100 million per project, really makes this meaningful for us, and this is going to be under 25 to 30-year concessions. Finally, earlier I talked about TDF's fiber backbone grid, and this is something for us as we think about fiber to the home that would be very attractive. We'll be able to backhaul all the traffic from these low-density networks onto our fiber backbone and drive incremental return. So we're currently in the middle of a number of tenders, and we're hopeful that as this process plays out, that we'll be in a position to secure one by the beginning of next year. So the telecom market in Europe is becoming increasingly active, and there's numerous examples of public listings as well as transaction comps. For the purpose of this, I've excluded the American tower cos. They tend to trade at one or two times multiples higher than the European comparables. The best marker in our eyes is probably Cellnex. It's a very similar business to TDF, all the same business lines that we have. Our business is a bit bigger, and I'd say maybe a bit more scalable. Cellnex IPO'd at right around 16 times and has traded much stronger in the post-IPO market. So on a value basis, looking at TDF, we think 16 to 18 times fits well with the other comps that we see in the European markets, still a discount to where we see the American tower cos, and the result is an enterprise value for the business in the 1.4 to 1.6 billion range. So on a combined basis, looking at the energy and communication sectors and really understanding, what the value proposition is to BIP, we've calculated a net asset value to BIP, by taking the midpoints from the two enterprise value ranges that I disclosed previously, which is $5 billion, and subtracting net debt from the two segments, which is $2 billion, to arrive at a net asset value to BIP of $3 billion, which represents a $700 million uplift from the street consensus NAV of where these businesses are valued today. So I've had the chance to take you through our businesses now, and I just wanted to finish off and talking a little bit about some of the investment themes we see on the M&A side. We continue on the energy side first. We continue to be encouraged by the pipeline, especially in North America. I think that we've seen that volatility in both share prices and commodities indicate that the public markets alone can't be relied upon for capital for the sector, which is creating, you know, good opportunities, we think, for private capital. MLPs have transitioned from the dominant M&A counterparty, and while they've recovered a lot of their cost of capital that it eroded earlier on, they're still internally focused on capital expenditure reductions, debt reductions, and sometimes restructuring their incentive distribution rights, which we think could lead to some recapitalization opportunities for us. There have been a number of large-scale acquisitions and mega mergers, if you will, in the transmission space. TransCanada's acquisition of Columbia, the Enbridge and Spectrum mergers have both resulted in either ongoing processes or processes that we expect to come to market soon, and we expect there's likely going to be more activity in the sector going forward. And finally, our focus remains on a number of large-scale entities where we believe there's good infrastructure portfolios that can be carved out, where the incumbent can either use the capital for debt reduction or capital expansion in other parts of their business. Jumping to telecom, in Europe, the story is around consolidation. As I mentioned earlier, mobile network operators are looking to find ways to accretively finance their business, and the sale of telecom towers is one of the things they're pursuing. We expect large portfolios in Germany, Spain, as well as the UK to come to market over the next year. On the tower side, we're also focused at looking for growth regions, and we're focused at looking abroad for areas that have, you know, the factors that we think will deliver that. So large populations, you know, low fixed broadband penetration, and early stage 3G and 4G rollout markets. And the markets that we see today that have those characteristics are India and LATAM. So those are markets we'll continue to monitor closely for what we think could be good value entries. And then finally on fiber, you know, we've been rolling out fiber in our UK utility business for the last 3 years. And I think it's really helped us understand, you know, where we like fiber and where we don't like fiber. And as I mentioned earlier, the utility characteristics that we see in France really kind of emulate the market that we're looking for. And we see that as an emerging market in Europe that has a lot of momentum behind it. So one that we'll continue to spend time on. So with that, that concludes what I wanted to go through today, and I think we have time for one question. If anyone wants to raise their hand, or we've got some mics in the room. Okay, doesn't look like any questions now, so I guess we'll wrap up, and if there's anything else, we can pick it up after. So I'll invite Ben up to continue on.
All right, thanks, Brian. My name is Ben Vaughan, and I'm the Chief Operating Officer of our infrastructure group. And before I get started, I have another polling question that I'd like to get input from the group on. So if we can get the polling question up. The topic is disruptive technologies, and you know, people don't often equate innovation with infrastructure, and it's probably a good time to remind everyone that we're not a high-tech company. But technological change is something we do think about, especially as it relates to underwriting residual values for assets that last many decades. So I don't know if it's possible to get the question up on the screen. So the question we have is, which of the following technological developments do you think will have the most impact on infrastructure in the next 10 to 20 year period? Fracking, driverless vehicles, distributed generation and energy storage, or advanced materials? So look, so I think the voting machine seems pretty clear. It looks like distributed generation and energy storage and driverless vehicles are probably the two hottest topics. I think we would probably generally agree, although these are all important things that we track and think about over time. So thanks for your feedback. So I'll move into my presentation. You know, another topic we think a lot about is investing with a contrarian mindset. And this really does some important things for us. It allows us to position ourselves for superior returns and protect downsides and invest on a value basis. But one of the things that I hope comes through today is it doesn't just mean doing the opposite of what everyone else is doing. To us, it really means having well-informed views and the organization and organizational commitment to act on those views. So I'm going to explain a bit about how we do this and highlight some recent examples. So this is important to us because we're targeting returns in the range of 12 to 15% without taking undue risk. And generally, I think people would think of infrastructure assets as being very low risk and having a lot of defensive characteristics, and probably generally would perceive the asset class to have lower return profiles, probably potentially down into the single digits. So to surface good transactions and opportunities, we can't just participate in well-attended auctions with players that have a lower cost of capital. We have to find opportunities to do bilateral deals. And, you know, the last point I'll make on this slide is, having a contrarian mindset also helps us think through when it might be a good time to sell assets and monetize. So it's not just buying for value, but also selling for good value as well. So what is our approach or our recipe? I think as we point out many times in our public materials, we have a long history as investors and lots of institutional experience. We have a global footprint with permanent local presence in many markets, and a long history as owner-operators, which helps us really stay focused on the underlying business performance, even though a business or sector may be in a down cycle. And we're also across many different capital markets. So this gives us good insight into whether certain sectors or geographies are undergoing times when capital is plentiful and cheap, or whether it's becoming scarce and expensive. So lately, we've really been focused on three key things. The first I'll touch on is reprioritizing our utility investments. And this is really shifting investments from North America to Brazil. The second is focusing on out-of-favor geographies, and I'll talk a bit about some investments we recently made in South America and India. And the third is increasing our investment in the energy sector in our pipeline business in the U.S. So in terms of reprioritizing our utility assets, a few years ago, we started to notice that return expectations for utility assets in North America were heading towards all-time lows. In part, this was, I think, driven by low interest rates, but there was a large universe of buyers that were active in the sector. And all of this was in an environment where there were relatively few organic growth opportunities. So lots of people were growing through consolidation. And at the same time that this was happening, Brazil had started to suffer a tremendous crisis of confidence. The country lost its investment grade status, and we noticed that there was little competition in the market and capital was becoming scarce. And I'd say the other observation we had at the time in Brazil, and we see this in many areas where there's distress, is the market kind of stopped differentiating between amazing assets, good assets, and not so good assets. So you tend to see a bit of a lack of differentiation in a down cycle or when there's distress, and we definitely saw that in Brazil at the time. So what did we do and how did we execute? In North America, we monetized some assets at what we think are great prices. We sold our Crosssound cable transmission business in New England, and we also sold our Ontario transmission business. We were able to run well-attended auctions and achieve, you know, what we think are mid-single-digit returns in those sales. And at the same time, we spent a lot of time, I describe it as filtering a large opportunity set that we saw in Brazil, and really focusing on what we thought were the highest quality opportunities that we could find. And we really honed in on two key things. The first was the NTS gas transmission assets, and I'll touch a bit more on those on the next slide. And the second is the electricity transmission business, which we think is very attractive. And, you know, so we were targeting, 12 to 14% after-tax real returns in those businesses with very conservative underwriting assumptions. And I'd say, you know, significant potential future upsides in those businesses. So in terms of the NTS transaction that Sam referred to in his opening, this is truly an example of a very rare opportunity. I think a few years ago, none of us would have guessed that these assets would come to market, or we certainly wouldn't have guessed that they would come to market in a way that we might be able to get a bilateral transaction done with the seller. And this really required all of our organizational capabilities to execute. We had a long-standing presence in Brazil and lots of conviction that the country would emerge from the current situation that it was in. We mobilized a large team quickly from around the world to do the underwriting in an efficient manner, and we had access to tremendous capital. So in total, you know, we were able to gather about $5 billion of equity and offer a deal with no funding or financing conditions, which allowed us to progress quickly. So the system itself, I would describe it as it's really like the Manhattan real estate of the Brazilian energy sector. It connects the most industrialized and populated states in the country with gas that comes from the west from Bolivia and from offshore and the north through LNG. And, you know, gas is increasingly used in Brazil for industrial production and for electricity production. And over the past 15 years has become a critical fuel that powers the economy. So the business is well positioned to grow. In general, the gas sector in Brazil is in its very early stages of development. And these are very modern assets. You know, most of the assets were built in around the mid 2000s. So it's a very high quality modern asset base. And in addition to that, you know, the underlying commercial aspects of the business are very attractive. The business is underpinned by stable long-term contracts under a very good regulatory framework. So we essentially get, you know, fixed price revenues that are fully inflation indexed, and we have no volume risks. So all the revenues are on a take or pay basis. So the business has extremely high margins and very low ongoing maintenance capital expenditures. And it has a great potential to continue to grow as the gas sector in Brazil continues to expand. So our investment thesis here is we really felt like we were buying, you know, an inflation-indexed Brazilian bond at a great return, with the potential for outsized returns if the country re-rates in the next 5 to 10 years. So to sum up on this opportunity, in terms of why this trade made sense to us, you know, we think the assets we were cycling into were lower risk and have a higher long-term return potential than the ones we monetized. We were essentially selling depreciating rate-based assets in a relatively low growth environment at mid-single digit returns and replacing them with very high quality assets with long-term contracted cash flow streams and very cash generative. Our AFFO yields going in will be in the range of 13%. And once again, we have full inflation protection and growth potential. So we thought this trade made a lot of sense to us. So with that, I'll move on to investing in out-of-favor geographies. You know, many years ago, we established offices in South America and in India. And in South America, we focused in Colombia, Peru, and Chile. And then eventually, a couple of years later in Latin America, opened up offices in Mexico, an office in Mexico. We think these are good countries to invest in because they're democracies with good rule of law. They have large middle classes that continue to develop, and they have, I think as it was pointed out on Brian's polling question, they have significant infrastructure deficits that are going to get addressed over time, with foreign capital and through the private sector. So we were very patient. For many years, we did no transactions out of these offices, but we learned and built our teams. And we noticed a couple of years ago that in India, there were some large conglomerates that had accumulated assets and used a lot of leverage to do that. And eventually we're going to run into challenges with their debt levels. And at the same time in South America, just the general downturn in the commodity cycle was causing some economic downturns there. And at the same time, construction companies that had accumulated large asset positions were also becoming distressed. So we'd anticipated these kinds of dynamics and focused a lot of time and energy on outreach programs and positioning ourselves with the owners of those kinds of assets. And so two transactions that resulted from this were our Gammon Toll Roads in India and the Rutas de Lima acquisition that we recently closed in Lima, Peru. These are very well-located toll roads in both of these jurisdictions. The ones in India really provide us with a broad portfolio of assets in different areas of the country. The ones in Lima are the three critical roads that provide access to the most important city in the country. So we think these are just very well-located, high-quality assets. We acquired them for good value, and they have tremendous growth potential over time. So with that, the final example I have, continues on a bit from Brian's comments about the NGPL gas business that we own with Kinder Morgan in the United States. This business underwent several years of challenges, really due to three things. There were the changing gas flows that Brian discussed. There was a regulatory reset, which impacted our tariffs. And the company, had a stretched balance sheet when we entered into it. But when you own, assets that have useful lives that span many generations, you're going to go through, some rough patches. And, through our offices in Calgary and Houston, we had strong conviction that these were very high quality assets and had good growth potential over the long term as the changes in the gas market settled out in North America. So we were patient. We didn't get too stressed. And in addition to that, I think our presence in Mexico really helped us assess the potential for the growing market that was developing in Mexico. So we worked with the team to help identify a number of both contracting and growth opportunities for the business. And we added to our investment. And we bought out some of the partners. And I reinforced and reinvigorated our partnership with Kinder Morgan. And we think this business has great potential in the coming years for us. So with that, to wrap up on execution, we execute our contrarian investing strategy by, building informed views and leveraging all of our institutional knowledge to do that. We have a global organization, so we have presence in multiple offices and lots of options to look at. We leverage our operating capabilities and teams to be able to move quickly and provide a high degree of speed when that matters to sellers. And our significant access to capital differentiates us because we can transact with a high degree of certainty. So in Brazil, we've been there for over 100 years. And we really, I think at the most fundamentally, we just didn't believe that the crisis that the country was going through was going to last forever and that it will turn around. In Peru and India, we had good local presence and we were able to act quickly and provide a lot of certainty when those two things mattered a lot. And at NGPL, we leveraged the knowledge and capabilities from our energy group to, redouble our conviction in the business and reinvest and increase our investment at a time when the business was viewed by some others as being out of favor. So with that, I'll conclude with a slide that I think Bruce has included in past investor days. It's a picture of moving against the herd. It hangs in the walls of many of our offices and reminds all of us at Brookfield who invest capital on your behalf about how important it is to think independently and have informed views when we're investing capital. So with that, that concludes my remarks. I can take one or two questions if there are any, or we can move on to Bahir. So we have one question.
applications, say, from now, capitalizing 40, 50% debt to cap on the asset, but the returns on it.
Thanks. You're really asking, I think the microphones are going on and off a little bit, what the long-term return potential is for NTS and given the currency and the capital structure. Just a couple of comments. Going in, the business is unlevered. So we're buying it with no debt, which we think is unique. And so part of the re-rating that I described is if we could put a normalized capital structure on it, which would be, at least 40 to 50% debt in the coming years, that would, surface a tremendous amount of capital that could come back to us and drive returns higher. None of that is factored into the base case return that I described. And in terms of the currency, the asset, all the cash flows are fully inflation protected. So, to the extent that there's inflation in Brazil and the currency weakens, given a relative inflation differential to, say, the U.S., we're going to get all that inflation in the cash flows of the business over time. So we just, we thought it was a very attractive proposition on both those fronts. Sorry, there's a question in the back left.
On one of the slides, you talk about raising $10 billion of third-party capital. How do you balance the desire to deploy this capital with ability to do it in a contrarian way? Because $10 billion is a lot of money, and just curious how both can...
Yeah, I understand. So would we, I guess given the amount of capital that we raised, can we deploy it all in a contrarian way? Or I think, as Bruce mentioned yesterday, we see, lots of opportunities to deploy capital. And I think it gets back to the scope of our business. We have many markets that we operate in, many sectors that we're in. I think Sam described in his opening remarks, we've added new geographies and new sectors. So as the business continues to grow, and as we're able to leverage the scale of our business, we don't generally see issues in terms of being able to prudently deploy the capital. Sure.
Structure to ensure people stay disciplined in the organization.
Yeah, maybe what I'll do is, maybe Sam, you can address that at the end of your comments, how we stay disciplined within the organization. Okay, that's great. Well, so let me bring Bahir up, and thank you very much.
So thank you, Ben, and good morning, everyone. So I'm here today to speak to you about our high-quality cash flows and really showcase our high-quality earnings that we generate in the business. Before I get into that, I wanted to review some of the themes from my presentation last year that I think are still relevant today, and briefly take you through the various updates of either things we've achieved from an accomplishment perspective since then or other changes in macro events that have occurred. And so last year I spoke in a bit of detail on our leverage metrics, the impact of rising rates on our business, and the impact of a strengthening U.S. dollar on our financial metrics. So first, on the financing front, we've been focused on executing a number of initiatives since last year, and as a result of that, our debt metrics have continued to improve steadily over time. We've extended our maturity profile by quite a bit and also further bolstered our liquidity position. We continue to have very good access to various capital markets around the world. In total, we completed about $2.7 billion of refinancings across our businesses. We've raised $375 million in the Canadian pref share market. That's a market that recently has become a very attractive place for us to raise capital in to supplement our overall liquidity profile. And lastly, alongside our partner at NGPL, we repaid approximately $600 million of fairly expensive debt in that business and improved the leverage metrics accordingly for NGPL. On rates, well, you all heard from Bruce yesterday. Our house view continues to be that we're operating in an environment of rates that are going to be lower for longer. But even in a rising rate environment, we don't think that this should overall impact our business all that much. Our debt is, and that's because our debt is primarily fixed with long dated duration or maturities, and a significant portion of our EBITDA is inflation linked and also tends to benefit by GDP growth. My presentation last year walked through this in quite a bit of detail. And a year later, this is still all what I said last year still holds and is pretty relevant. Also, last year, almost everyone we spoke to was very focused on foreign exchange, especially in light of the significant depreciation of the Brazilian real. We ran some sensitivities that incorporated some pretty conservative assumptions and showed that on an overall basis, the impact to our business would be relatively manageable, given our diversification and our FX hedging strategy. A year later, well, currencies have for the most part stabilized, and the real has actually appreciated by 25%. So now people are focused on Brexit and what that could mean to the British pound going forward. Well, for Brookfield Infrastructure, we're pretty well insulated from future movements in the pound. And that's because our exposure from an FFO and net equity perspective has been fully hedged. And so with that as a recap to last year's themes, I wanted to spend a bit of time taking you through some of Brookfield Infrastructure's key strengths. We highlight three of them on the slide here. First, and I think most of you are familiar with the fact that our business is pretty simple to understand. It's essentially composed of several or networks around the world that provide essential services for the global economy. And what we're doing day in day out is just moving goods, people, data, energy, water, et cetera, through our networks. And we just get paid an access fee for people accessing our various systems. Second, we have a strong balance sheet. We spent a bit of time on this during last year's presentation. We set out our top 5 to 6 principles that we follow when it comes to refinancings. And I just gave you an update on the state of our balance sheet as it stands today. So we're in really good shape from that perspective heading into 2017. And so then really the bulk of my discussion today will focus on our high quality earnings and how that should be assessed. So what do we mean by high quality earnings? So really for our business, there's three ways to measure or evaluate our earnings. And that's by looking at the low volatility nature of our cash flow streams, the high margins that we earn across the various sectors we operate in, and the strong cash conversion ratios that we have. The low volatility in our results stem from the fact that over 90% of our cash flow streams are either regulated or contracted. First, on the regulated front, we operate businesses in 5 continents and invest in businesses with attractive regulatory frameworks with regulators that are well established. And so these are in great countries like the UK, the US, Australia, Chile, et cetera. We also have long-term contracts in place. Important to note here that we're generally operating infrastructure that is very critical to moving customers' goods to the end user. Our customers are typically seeking to reduce volatility in their capital, in their cost structure. They're looking to manage their supply of goods to the best of their abilities. And they also tend to prefer to contract for capacity just so that they know they have it if they ever need it. And so for those reasons, we have pretty long-dated contracts in place with them. And the average duration on these contracts today is about 12 years in length. And these counterparties that we're operating with are generally solid, majority of which are investment-grade rated entities. Our business also has a very attractive margin profile. Overall, we've grown our margins on a holistic basis for the business from about 47% in 2011 to 60% in 2016. And that is continuing to trend upwards. Our margins are attractive across sectors, and there's really two big reasons for that. The first is our costs are predominantly fixed. Therefore, any kind of top-line growth that you typically see in this business tends to flow through to the bottom line. And the second reason is the fact that our networks, for the most part, offer non-discretionary services to these customers. And they're also businesses that are very capital intensive, that require significant upfront capital to build or to replace. And generally, these kind of businesses demand higher margins. We also have low maintenance capital requirements in the business. There's really three key factors for this. First, a number of our systems are newly constructed or are young in nature. Our assets are mainly comprised of concrete and steel structures that have limited wear and tear associated with them. You know, think about our connections that we're installing in our UK regulated distribution business. Once these connections are installed underneath these homes, there's little or absolutely no work that you need to do on these once they've been done. And lastly, several of our businesses are able to recover most of their capital spend through their regulated frameworks. And here, think of examples of our regulated terminal in Queensland or our Chilean transmission system. And so these high quality earnings are demonstrated by the cash that we generate in the business. Our cash conversion rates at Brookfield Infrastructure are very strong. I will walk through some numbers in a later slide to show you how that all works, but it's really driven or a testament of the stable and growing earnings that we have combined with the low maintenance capital requirements in the business. And to analyze the free cash flow that we generate in this business, we believe that adjusted funds from operations, or AFFO, is the best measure to use, as it's the best proxy for the actual cash that's available for distribution or for reinvestment back in the business. And so while we're speaking about key metrics, you know, a question we often get asked by a lot of people is, you know, what's the difference between AFFO and net income? And why is it that we don't use net income as a key metric when we're analyzing our results? What we wanted to highlight here is that AFFO and net income for our business are pretty much similar, with the exception of three items that we note here on the slide. So in preparing this analysis, we compiled our results on a cumulative basis for the periods ranging from 2010 to 2015. And as you can see from the adjustments we note here, the first two being deferred income taxes and mark-to-market gains and losses on our hedging activities, they tend to be either items that are insignificant for a particular period of time, or they could be more volatile and vary across or between different periods. But if you look at them on a cumulative basis, they generally tend to net down to a smaller number, as the slide shows. And so really, we're left with depreciation and amortization being the most significant difference between our net income and AFFO. And it comes down to whether or not you think depreciation and amortization is an appropriate capital charge for us to take into our results or take into account for the capital that's required to maintain the earnings profile in the business going forward. Our view is that maintenance CapEx is the best way to assess this capital charge. And that's because our accounting policies result in a number of reasons why depreciation and amortization tends to be very different than maintenance CapEx. It's important to note here that we're not trying to make generalizations about the merits of one metric over the other. We're just speaking to the specifics as they relate back to our business. Some of these differences might be well known or more obvious than others, so let's touch briefly on each one of them. First, under IFRS, we made an accounting policy choice to fair value or revalue our property, plant, and equipment each year. And since our assets tend to grow in value over time, that leads to higher PP&E figures, which then leads to higher depreciation charges as well. Second, our purchase price accounting methodology is different than most companies in the sector. When it comes down to purchase price adjustments, which are the differences between what you pay for a business over and beyond what the book value of that business is, we tend to capitalize that adjustment to the hard asset that we bought or the property, plant, and equipment versus many others in the sector who capitalize that to goodwill. And the difference is that goodwill doesn't get depreciated under IFRS rules, but property, plant, and equipment obviously does. And lastly, we own businesses with long-lived assets, which, if maintained properly, tend to outlast their accounting useful lives by much, much longer periods. So before I go into and just speak about these three differences in a bit more detail, I wanted to just lay out visually here, just to give you an idea of the magnitude of the differences between our IFRS depreciation and our annual maintenance CapEx. And I think, you know, as you can see from the slide, the impact is pretty significant. So I've got a few case studies to walk you through each adjustment to help explain this a bit better using real-life examples. So the first case study that I wanted to use here relates to our South American transmission business, or Transelec, to address the difference of that arise from revaluation policies. Just a quick reminder on this business, or just some quick highlights about it. This is the transmission system that serves about 98% of the population in the country. This is a perpetual business regarded by many as probably the best transmission asset in South America. It's got one of the best regulatory frameworks we've seen, in fact, around the world, where we earn an attractive regulated return based on the replacement cost of the business that goes up by inflation each year, and that return is stipulated in law. So just a real trophy asset in our business. We've owned this business since 2006, and we've demonstrated a strong track record of identifying and executing on a number of organic growth projects. Over the years, we've improved the operating margins in the business by quite a bit. And we've also seen lower discount rates in this business as a result of the business being or getting to be more mature and Chile becoming a much more attractive country for people to invest capital in. And so while we don't get to record this business at a value anywhere close to what it's actually worth or what we would be willing to sell it for, its value has over time appreciated by about $700 million. So these revaluations lead to higher property, plant, and equipment balances, and in turn higher depreciation expense each year. But in reality, these revaluations are not really tied to any incremental capital that we would need to put or spend in this business to maintain the earnings profile in the business. And the second difference can be illustrated by looking at our telecom, European telecom business, or TDF, that Brian went through earlier in his presentation. We acquired this business in 2015. From an accounting perspective, we valued the business based on a discounted cash flow or DCF approach consistent with our underwriting models. And the value that this discounted cash flow models kicked out, we basically attributed it all or capitalized it into the hard asset or the property, plant, and equipment that we ended up buying. What many in the industry would do is they would book this business based on its original book value and put that in property, plant, and equipment. And in this case, the $2 billion purchase price adjustment that arose here, they would classify that as goodwill. And as I mentioned before, goodwill doesn't get depreciated, whereas property, plant, and equipment gets depreciated over time. So that results in a very large incremental depreciation charge that we have to take into our results each year. And lastly, the third example that I wanted to touch on deals with differences arising from accounting versus economic useful lives. The business I wanted to touch on here is our UK regulated distribution business, which is the leading independent utility in the UK. And so in this business, what we do is we connect homes to the electric or gas grid of the country. These connections are done beneath the homes. They are made up of indestructible piping and will be good as long as the house is left standing. Under IFRS rules, we are mandated to depreciate this property, plant, and equipment, generally using about 25 to 30 years there. Where in the reality is, as we all know from homes, the network asset should outlast that 25 to 30 year duration by a big margin. So as I mentioned, I think after going through those examples, hopefully it's pretty clear why we think maintenance capex is the appropriate capital charge to be taken into account when you're analyzing our business. And that makes AFFO probably the best measure to use when analyzing results. I did, however, want to highlight one item or one concept that doesn't get captured in our AFFO, and it relates to our finite life concession businesses. Today, roughly a quarter of our business relates to assets that are under long-term concession agreements, and therefore they're not perpetual in nature. So we would need to adjust for cash flows that are effectively or should be classified as a return of capital versus a return on capital. We estimate this charge by using the calculation that we provide here on the screen. And when we run through the numbers today, we think on an LTM basis, this number is about $40 million of our annual cash that should be classified as a return of capital. We think about this every year when we're setting our distribution levels. The impact to our payout ratios is insignificant. And should this number become a more meaningful number in the future, we will definitely be providing more clarity on this on our disclosures going forward. And so before I wrap up my remarks and hand it back off to Sam, I wanted to conclude on this slide by tying some of the concepts together that I ran through and show you how all this works using numbers. And so as you can see, our EBITDA has grown at a much faster rate than our maintenance capex, which has led to a significant increase in our unlevered net cash flows. And so this translates to a nice, steady increase to our cash conversion ratios that have increased from about 87% in 2012 to almost 90% in 2016, and that continues to trend upward. After you layer on interest, cash taxes, and other items, we arrive at an adjusted funds from operation, or AFFO, of about $800 million for fiscal year 2016, or at least that's the forecast for the year using by annualizing the first 6 months of the year. And that AFFO has grown by over 20% on a CAGR basis for the relevant period. And so with that, thank you for your attention, and maybe I'll take a couple of questions if there are any. Yeah.
Why has the maintenance capital as a percentage of EBITDA declined over the past 5 years?
I just think because EBITDA is growing at a, we've seen just such incredible organic growth in our business. As Sam mentioned earlier, it's grown by about 11 to 12%. So it's just outpacing our maintenance capex levels that have been pretty steady and tend to grow by almost inflation each year, which is not a big number, whereas the EBITDA itself is growing at a double-digit level.
Thanks.
So is the maintenance capital normalized or is it actual?
This is actual maintenance capex. It's in the range of what our long-term sustaining capex levels are, which we disclose on each year in our materials. Okay, if there's any more questions, I'll take them later.
Okay, thanks, Bahir. Thanks for the accounting lesson. And I'm back, I guess. So this is the wrap-up. I'm going to try for my closing presentation here to bring together the themes that you've heard today and translate it into what it means for BIP. You know, our overall strategy that I mentioned at the outset is to build a company that will perform well through all business cycles. And, you know, what we try to do or strive to do is generate low-risk, sustainable cash flows, much like a utility, and at the same time have a business that generates attractive growth that will provide inflation protection and capital appreciation. So first thing, I guess, is, you know, let's just talk about BIP's utility-like cash flow characteristics. And when I think about utilities, I think of businesses that are, you know, regulated or contracted, have minimal volume exposure, and have tariff certainty. So with respect to regulated and contracted cash flows, over 90% of BIP's cash flows are regulated or contracted. In terms of volume exposure, 60% of our businesses have no volume risk as either they operate under take-or-pay agreements or they earn availability-based payments. Now, while technically 40% or the remaining 40% of our businesses are volume exposed, I would say that these businesses, you know, are critical, highly utilized infrastructure assets, you know, like toll roads and railroads, and they provide essential services, and they really operate in businesses or areas where they have few and in some cases no alternatives. So, in fact, we're not really taking much in the way of volume risk. We've got very limited, you know, merchant exposure, and that's because our tariffs, you know, because we operate in regulated and contracted businesses, are effectively, you know, locked in under those frameworks. And then one of the unique characteristics that we have that I'd say many utilities don't have is diversification. And, you know, what we achieve through, you know, diversification is basically, you know, a lot of risk mitigation because of all the different regulatory frameworks and counterparties that that we serve. And today we have about 30 businesses that operate in different markets and in different regulatory frameworks. So we put together this slide, which we hope would help, you know, illustrate, you know, just how solid we think our cash flows are. And just to explain what it is, we've effectively taken the business that we have as of today, or probably as of June, and then on a same store constant currency basis, assumed that we've owned them for the past 5 years. And what you can see that is that in pretty much all our business segments, we've had very stable, consistent cash flows. And we think that's just a great illustration of just the utility-like business that we have. So the next thing I wanted to do was, just talk about the attractive growth in our business. And, we really do that through three ways, as you can see on the slides here, through indexation in the business, reinvesting in the business, and then through new investments. And I'll just touch each of those quickly. One of the great elements of infrastructure assets and investing in infrastructure is the fact that we've got these great revenue frameworks. And it's something that when we look at a business, and we talked about NTS earlier, and what we liked about it was the indexation to inflation that business had. And today, across all our businesses, about 70% of our EBITDA is indexed to inflation. And what that means is that on a year-in, year-out basis, we would generally expect that about there'd be 3% annual growth to our results just from these contracts. The other key contributor to growth is the capital that we invest into our existing businesses to accommodate customer demand. And as we've probably said many times in the past, from a capital allocation perspective, this is the one area where we think it's the best way to utilize our capital, because it generates the highest returns at the lowest risk. And the reason that's the case is because generally, whenever we're looking to compete for those projects, we're generally doing with a business that's in place that has a significant cost advantage over other competitors. So it's the right thing for us to do. What we put on this chart here is just to show you how the ability for our business to generate organic growth has changed over time. In 2010, we invested on average a run rate of $200 million, or about 5% of our invested capital, into the business. In the next 2 years, we've increased that to about, almost 4 to 5 times that run rate, to about $900 million a year. And that represents about 15 to 20% of our invested capital. Now, it's probably fair to ask if we can sustain this run rate. And we generally believe we can. I'd say that to begin with, we've got, great visibility, as a result of our backlog, where we have about $2 billion of approved ongoing projects today. And we're, executing those projects in our utilities, our ports, our toll roads, and our pipelines. In addition to those contracted projects, we've got a pretty large opportunity set that is sitting behind the pipe, you might say. We talked a couple earlier. I think Brian mentioned the opportunities that we're looking forward to achieving in the U.S. energy. He also talked about the fiber to the home opportunities in France. Two other exciting opportunities that we think we'll be able to convert into backlog the next couple of years will be the first one's in the UK with the smart meter program rollout. That's a roughly 12 billion pound rollout where we've already secured a couple projects that are in our backlog. We've got two that we're bidding on today, and we're highly confident that we'll win a number more. The other exciting projects that we think about regularly are the Brazilian government infrastructure program. Just in relation to our rail and road assets in that country, there's about 5 billion reais of projects that we have the opportunity to have bilateral discussions with the government to achieve their objectives of investing in infrastructure. It's an interesting program. It'll take some time, you know, for us to achieve these projects, and you know, we may not get all of them, but the government has provided an attractive return that effectively translates into a levered 14% real rate of return. And probably the nicest part about it, in as it relates to our toll roads, is that we don't take any traffic risk. So in effect, it's like a utility type return. The third area of growth, you know, sometimes gets the most publicity, is just our ability to source new investments. Let me just move it. As you can see from this slide, we've invested about $6.6 billion of equity capital over the last 7 to 8 years. So our track record of being able to deploy capital throughout the years has been very good. And we've executed a number of strategic acquisitions that have been fabulous for the business. I think BBI was a great transaction. And Nexus, which is where we grew or more than doubled our BUK business. And then the most recent transaction, Asciano, we think is going to be a fantastic transaction for us as well. And the reason we can do that is, you know, we do have this large global market presence and the significant access to capital that we talked about earlier, you know, to really drive new investment opportunities. Today, we've got about 15 offices around the world and over 160 professionals just dedicated to infrastructure. So now that I've covered off the BIP's security and growth attributes, wanted to review BIP from a value perspective. You know, we think BIP is an attractive investment for investors such as yourselves, you know, for three, you know, main reasons. One is we think it's compelling relative value, and we know the stock market is relatively strong these days. But we think compared to many other investments, you know, BIP is very interesting. We trade a discount to what we believe the company is worth on an intrinsic value basis. And we've got just an exciting growth period ahead of us. I'm going to touch on each one of these very briefly. We put together this slide, and we recognize that there's not many comparable companies to Brookfield Infrastructure in the world, but we thought that comparing ourselves to the S&P 500 Utilities Index, you know, was a fair comparison. You know, some great companies in that index. You know, they have very similar investment attributes to BIP. And I think, you know, as you look at the chart, we compare very favorably, you know, from a yield perspective. We think we're better value, and we've delivered, you know, much better growth over the last 7 or 8 years than the utility sector has done. You might also ask, you know, how is BIP trading relative to its historic comps? And so we put together this chart that basically shows that, you know, we're actually trading at a lower level when you look at a price to AFFO perspective today and throughout most of this year than we have for, you know, most of our years in the past. And that's pretty surprising given the fact that we've probably never had the growth in the business that we have today that we had in the past, other than maybe when we just bought Babcock. So this is a real exciting period for us. From a discount to intrinsic value, you would have saw the spotlight we did in Brian's section to show, you know, what we think our value of the assets is versus street consensus. And that's an analysis that we've done for the last 3 years. So, you know, I encourage you, if you've forgotten or if you weren't here 2 years ago, we did it on our utilities business. Last year, we did it in our transportation business. And while it is a somewhat subjective analysis, you know, we do believe that, you know, our overall business probably trades at about a 30% discount, or at least it's valued at a 30% discount from street consensus. And if you go back and just, you know, see how we've done over the years, you know, in 2014, you know, we had an estimate that our utilities business was worth about 35% more than street consensus. Since that time, you know, we sold the Ontario transmission business at levels above what we thought it was worth at that time. Our UK business, which is about 50% of our cash flows, is growing at a run rate of 15% per annum. And that's well above, you know, what our estimates would have assumed at that point in time. So if anything, we probably understated the value of the assets back in 2014. Last year, you know, we did a feature on the transport segment, and, you know, we've just made that business even better this year. We've executed the growth projects at TRAPAC and BLI, and we've expanded our portfolio through the Asciano and the Peruvian Toll Road and Indian Toll Road transactions. So that business is going better as well. So I've just got a couple more slides, but they're probably the most important slides that I have. And I think this is maybe one just to take a second on. You know, while the numbers all show that BIP is great value, you know, I think everything is forward-looking as opposed to backward-looking. And from a forward-looking perspective, this really tells the story. You know, we're entering a period where our outlook is extremely bright. We've got three wedges of growth. The first is that we are commissioning a huge number of projects over the next 3 years. They're about $1.6 billion. And these are projects that generally have mid to high teen returns. Second, we just completed in the last 3 months three transactions where we invested $660 million. And our going in yield for those transactions is about 9 to 10%. So that's just going to start flowing into our numbers in the next couple of quarters. And then lastly, we're on track to investing over $1 billion into our Brazilian utility transactions. As we said earlier, these are businesses that we expect to close either the end of this year or early 2017, and they'll generate going in yields of about 13% plus. So all in all, those three things taken together really show that we've got a great number of quarters and years ahead. And then the last slide is probably a pretty messy slide, and we try to emulate Brian Lawson, who's a master at predicting the future. Sorry, Brian. But we really wanted to show, that there's two paths for capital appreciation in Brookfield Infrastructure. On the left-hand side, you know, gives you sort of a re-rating path. And, today we trade at a 4.6% yield. And, I'd say the first thing is I mentioned that our peer group generally trades at a yield, somewhere in the mid-threes. But we've also tried to show that, the assets that we own, if you sold them in the market, they generally would sell at returns of around 8 to 9%. They have attributes where they generally are expected to grow around 5% a year. Our growth rate in our business has actually, on a historic basis, been far higher than 5%. But we use 5 as sort of a target level. And just on that basis, it would explain or suggest that a proper yield is somewhere in a 3 to 4% range. If you look at the sort of what that drives from a value perspective, today we trade around $34. We think there's a very credible path to a mid-40 stock price. If you don't think there's going to be a re-rating of the stock, and obviously that's possible, we can just continue doing what we've been doing for the last 8 to 9 years, and that's generating attractive growth. And on that basis, we've just, given some sensitivity analysis of, if we grow within our target range or if we grow at what we've done in the last 12 years or
8 years at 12%, we again drive a very attractive capital appreciation for the units. So in closing, I hope you found our presentation informative. You know, we think that the main takeaway is that, you know, BIP is an investment that you should hold through all investment cycles. And basically the term we've coined is that BIP is a stock for all seasons. So thank you, and be happy to take questions. You know, before I start the questions, there was one question from the back. So before I forget, I believe the question was, how do we stay disciplined? And it was in relation to contrarian investing and having, you know, lots of firepower, both with the liquidity we have at BIP, but also with the additional capital from our investment partners. And, you know, I think the way I'd answer that is that there's two ways how we keep discipline. The first one is culture. So, you know, we instill a culture in our investment professionals that they are supposed to and have to act like owners. And as a result, you know, they aren't going to invest capital any differently than it was, you know, money in their own pocket. And as a result, you know, there's no motivation on their part to invest capital poorly. They're not doing it for vanity or ego reasons. But also, you know, the other critical factor is, you know, our compensation programs. You know, we align our compensation such that, you know, people get rewarded based off of investment performance. They get compensated through options at Brookfield Asset Management, but they also get compensated with direct carry, if you want to call it that, against the funds that we invest. And so unless the assets do well, they won't collect their LTIP. So I guess that's basically how we do it. Just in front here. Yep, it's coming.
Sam, looking at the chart, before it kind of zoomed up the last X number of months, it actually went
down.
I think it was down as low as 30 and a half. You subsequently
split it
3 for 2, and now it's 34.
It went down to 30 and a half, I think, within the last year or so. Just looking at the chart, the upper right-hand side, and subsequently split 3 for 2 is now at 34. I wonder if you know of any reason, whether for BIP or for infrastructure stocks, why it would have run down like that and why it might have run up.
So I think the simple explanation is that at the end of last year and beginning part of this year, you know, there was a, you know, significant correction in the MLP market as a result of the decline in oil and gas prices, oil prices in particular. And, you know, we traded, I guess, in sympathy to that. You know, there could have been some you know, BIP related issues, which was, you know, we were in the market at that time with a bid for Asciano. There was some speculation because we were using units that, there would be flowback. And so maybe that helped depress the stock a bit. Personally, I think it was mostly just us, trading in line with the market, and the markets, you know, recovered strongly. And so we quickly gained that back. I think the only missed opportunity from our perspective is when we saw that and we clearly traded far below where we ever should have. We would have loved to have been in the market buying units, but because we had a takeover bid in the market for Asciano, we were precluded from buying units. And so we unfortunately missed an opportunity to buy. I hope many of you were able to buy units, though. Hope that explains it.
You make the point that much of your business is contractual and therefore very reliable. Could you speak to counterparty risk of your customers and their viability? A lot of these customers are in, you know, tough industries, iron ore, coal, energy. Maybe you could speak to the, you know, the strength of that.
Sure. I'd say the first thing is, from a overall perspective, there's no one customer that we are particularly exposed to. So, our largest customer exposure, maybe in the order of magnitude of 1-2% of EBITDA. I'm not sure it's even that. But as I think about sort of the chunkier customers, it would primarily relate to our railroads and I guess our coal terminal in Australia. Just dealing first with the coal terminal, that's the easiest one. There we have, very little, risk, or at least I don't lose, much sleep at night because, those are the lowest cost, metallurgical coal mines in the world. We have a mechanism where all the costs are socialized across all the customers. So even if one falls over, then, the next customer picks up those costs. You really only have an issue if every one of them, went bankrupt. But given that it is the lowest cost in the world, and obviously met coal has now doubled in price. It's gone from $85 to $200. So they're making a ton of money today. We're not worried about the coal customers. Iron ore customers, it's a bit more challenging. It's, I'd say the price has done better than we've expected. As we look at, again, our customer base, I would put them sort of at the mid-level of cost competitiveness, that they're not the BHPs or the Rios in Australia. They're sort of the next tier down, but they're still quite cost competitive. They make money at this level. We have one that's still, I'd say, in ramp-up phase, KML. We monitor that credit very closely. We have provided them some support and some breaks on the tariff, which they've got from all their other suppliers, and that was in return for them getting support from the Chinese banks. Effectively, it's a Chinese company. It's all Chinese money from both the banking and equity perspective. But other than that one customer, I'd say, the rest are pretty diverse and not ones that we're worried about too much. Any other questions? There's Sherilyn here.
Thank you. Sherilyn Radbourne from TD Securities. Just wanted to ask a question about the capital project backlog, which is obviously at record levels. Can you just speak to whether it's typical for you to start earning a return on that capital as the projects proceed, or basically once the project is fully commissioned?
I would say in almost every case, we don't earn anything until they're commissioned. It's pretty rare that we earn at least any cash flow or any accounting earnings during the period. I mean, there is some mechanisms where within the allowed return, it may accrue up into the rate base, but it's not something that we would accrue during a period of time. Sorry, in the middle here.
Hi. Any pressure on regulated allowable returns based on lower levels of interest rates?
Yes. Short answer is yes.
Can you give sort of a magnitude of how much of your business might be in that zone?
So look, that's our constant battle. In South America, we've had pressures in our Chilean transmission business and maybe to a lesser extent in our Colombian regulated distribution business. to reduce rates. You know, we've been able to sort of offset them somewhat. So while the allowed returns have come off a bit, you know, they allowed us, you know, some higher recoveries on costs. And so it's been a bit of an offset, but I'd say, you know, there's been a bit of a drag. Normally, you would see a nice step up because of inflation. I'd say that's eaten into, to a certain extent, some of that inflation indexation that both of those systems have. Probably the most dramatic impact that we've had is our regulated terminal in Australia. You know, we're just entering into a new five-year cycle. It started, I think, in July. And the WACC there, you know, dropped pretty dramatically from, you know, high nines to high fives. Now the you do have a lot lower interest rates, so that somewhat counteracts that. But you know, we would have seen our equity returns, you know, drop there. You know, I think we reported that it's a couple of $1 million a quarter. So you know, doesn't feel good, but that's sort of part of the bargain. You know, we do our best with the regulators to manage that and try to get a fair return. But that's you know, that is, you know, the pluses and minuses to having a utility business. You know, sometimes you win, sometimes you lose a little bit. A question up there.
Sam, I just wanted to come back to airports, which you highlighted last year in your comments earlier with respect to Invipar. And you're talking about due diligence. I just wanted to... Was that due diligence just generally around Invipar and it not coming together as a deal, or was that specific to Sao Paulo or the airport asset class? I guess just ultimately, have your views changed on that, on airports from last year?
No, look, we like the asset class, and, you know, we in particular like the long-term traffic potential for South America and Brazil in particular. You know, there was just a number of specific issues related to the structure that the owners, you know, had agreed to when they bought the asset. It was a relatively short life concession, very expensive payments, ongoing payments to the government, and, you know, we just weren't comfortable with a number of those factors. So those are the main reasons.
Thanks, Sam.
So if I don't see any other, oh, there's one. Okay, we'll take one last question, and then I think Suzanne's going to kick me off stage here. Oh, okay, sorry.
Andrew Kusky, Credit Suisse. Sam, maybe just give us some context. Now that the capital backlog has grown, you've actually got quite a bit of organic growth. Are there some natural consequences that come from that? One being, do you get to high grade your M&A opportunities at this stage versus what you did in the past, where you maybe had to do M&A to effectively spend some of the excess cash flow? And then secondly, is there a cultural shift that happens within BIP where it becomes more operationally focused and focused on the growth of the platform assets versus trying to find M&A opportunities?
Yeah, good question. I don't think anything's changed. I think our mindset has always been, let's focus on the best value opportunities first. And if those are organic, then they're organic. If they're new investments, then you know we'll focus there. You know, I think the benefit is, you know, we have multiple balls in the air at one time, so we have lots of things to choose from. And, you know, in addition to sort of high grade them, as you said, you know, picking the best and focusing on those first, you know, we have to look at our means. So, you know, we can't do every deal in the world. And while we have lots of liquidity and we're blessed with lots of support from Brookfield and other investors, we just, you know, don't have unlimited capital. So we have to live within our means and we'll just do the deals that we can afford. So... that means there's lots of stuff that we say no to. You don't hear about it, but there's lots of things we don't do. Okay. Sorry, Bert. We'll answer your question later on. Okay, Suzanne.
So we'll take a break. It's about 10:25 now. We'll reconvene back here at 10:45 for the next session. Thanks.